everybody. I am Rob Farley from the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky. And with me is Matthew Duss, who is policy analyst at the Center for American Progress and also the director of Middle East Progress. Is that correct?
It is, yes.
That's right. Yeah, more or less. And we are here today to talk about, well, first, thank you for tuning in. We're here today to talk about a few issues surrounding the Arab Spring, Israeli foreign policy, and Israeli relations with its neighbors and its, in a sense, Israel near abroad. How are you doing today, Matt?
Very well, Rob. Thanks. How are you?
I am fine. I'm fine. The weather is fantastic in Lexington, Kentucky today. I think it's going to be about 80 and no rain. It's going to be very nice.
So. Yeah, it's gorgeous in D.C. today, too. I feel like fall has arrived and none too soon.
Right. We had some low 60s in last week in Lexington. It felt like Seattle. I feel like Seattle in November or something. But
yeah, it's funny. It's people kept saying that here in D.C., too. But as you know, having lived in Seattle as I did, it rarely ever rains that hard for that long.
Right.
Right. It was ridiculous last week. It was monsoon season in D.C.
Right. Yeah, no, there's a big difference between, say, Seattle and Eugene on that. I think Eugene gets about twice Seattle's rainfall. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we're not here to talk about Seattle or Eugene.
I'll just cross that off.
Okay, well, how about we just delete that? So we're here to discuss... let's start with the obvious, right, which is the protesters' attack on the Israeli embassy in Cairo. You want to sort of set the stage on that? You've probably followed it a little bit more closely than I am, and I've read the most of the coverage.
It was, you know, a protest that had you know, it was a protest against, you know, the state of things, the SCAF, the failure, I think, to the SCAF, meaning the current government of Egypt, which is, you know, essentially the next level down of military leadership after the top Mubarak leadership was ousted. Just, you know, discontent at the pace of things, the continuing economic lack of economic opportunity, et cetera. And as these things tend to do, part of this was anger, was expressed as anger toward Israel. And it really got out of control with Egyptian protesters storming, breaking through a barrier that had been set up around the Israeli embassy in Cairo and storming inside and setting a fire and really, really horrible stuff.
Right. Now, the Israeli diplomats have been evacuated and none of them were injured, right? Is that correct? Or?
No. I don't believe anyone was injured, but from what I've seen, I think it was very, very tense for a while. I think
the protester
has actually broken inside and were about two rooms away from where the embassy employees had taken refuge.
Right, and at least at the, I mean, eventually Egyptian commandos came in and I believe rescued the Israeli diplomats. But before then, there was a fairly tense situation because the Egyptian police and army weren't really doing anything about it. Go ahead.
Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, according to his account, placed a call to President Obama, and Defense Minister Ehud Barak, Israeli Defense Minister, placed a call to his counterpart, Leon Panetta, and, you know, they both, Obama and Panetta, I'm actually not sure if Obama himself made a call, but Panetta did, and other American officials reached out to their Egyptian counterparts to get them to act on it.
Right. And when we think about it, we do need to remember that it is always it is the responsibility of the host country of any kind of embassy, even if it's an unpopular country within that embassy, to protect the embassy. Right.
Yeah,
embassies are technically or legally part of the home country rather than the host country, but obviously they depend on the protection of local police and so forth.
Right.
And so obviously there was some sort of fall down. But it's obviously also good that no Israelis were injured. Now, was there a similar attack on the Israeli consulate in Alexandria? I understood there were some protests there.
I heard of the protests. I don't know if there was an attack on the consulate. Yeah. But no, as you said, a very serious breach of protocol and just a very serious signal of growing anger, not only just against I think it is important to understand that this was a bigger protest than just against the Israeli embassy, but one of the objects of their anger turned out to be, you know, the diplomatic presence of Israel there in Cairo. It's one of a range of issues on which the Egyptian demonstrators really feel that their new government has simply failed to follow through.
Right. I mean, there seems to be I mean, I guess the elephant in the room here that's obvious is that the state of Egyptian relations with Israel are not particularly popular with the protest movement, even the protest movement that was in Tahrir Square several months ago. Right? There were many other Mubarak policies that were not popular with the protesters, but one of them was the current state of relations with Israel. This was exacerbated by the incident in Sinai, where I believe five Egyptian soldiers were killed, or I can't remember if they were soldiers or police. And has been exacerbated, or there have been sort of disconcerting warning signs about the interest and ability of the Egyptian government to maintain this particular relationship in the face of domestic protest. And this appears to be another sort of indication that this is, that we are talking about a relationship that may not be tenable given what we expect, or the direction we expect Egyptian politics to take, or the directions we can predict Egyptian politics will take in the next 6 to 8 months, right? That there just doesn't seem to be a lot of popular-based support for maintaining this kind of relationship with Israel. I mean, is that sort of your take, too, or?
It is my take. I think we need to kind of disentangle a few things in here. I actually have a piece that just went up in the Near East Quarterly on the Arab Spring in Palestine, the way that the Israeli-Palestinian issue, well, I think to go back a bit, I mean, it's kind of critiquing some claims made shortly after the beginning of the Arab Spring or the Arab Awakening, whatever. I tend toward calling it an Arab Awakening. But, you know, there were claims by some early on that since, you know, there wasn't a lot of Israeli flag burning in Tahrir Square and elsewhere, and that so much of these demonstrations were focused against their own governments, that this showed that, you know, all along the Israeli-Palestinian issue has just been this figment of in the minds of propagandists and people who hate Israel trying to distract from the real issues. And I thought that was incorrect then, but I think it's simply we all can see it's simply nonsense now. I think I submitted this piece a couple months ago when that wasn't just patently obvious. But even back in the early days of the demonstrations, there were still pockets, you know, of people bringing up the Palestinian issue. But I think it's correct that, yes, the overwhelming focus of those early demonstrations was against Mubarak, was against Ali and those in Tunisia. But as we've moved into, I think, a new phase of the Arab Awakening, we see more of a focus on these kinds of regional issues, pan-Arab issues, whatever term you want to use. And the Israeli-Palestinian issue has come up more, and it will continue to come up. I think when I was in Jerusalem just a few weeks ago, I spoke to an EU official who put it really well. He said, listen, the first stage of this awakening had to do with individuals versus their governments and their governments' failures to govern competently or honestly or provide opportunity to provide political freedom. This new phase we're entering is much more about national dignity, individual dignity first, national dignity now. And as people in these countries start to deal with these questions of national dignity, we really should expect the failure of the Arab states to kind of address the Palestinian issue effectively to come up.
Right. I guess I agree in almost all points there. I mean, it's very interesting because as you suggested towards the beginning there, there has long been this conversation regarding Israel's relationship with the autocratic regimes around Israel. And one part of this conversation has essentially made it axiomatic that Arab hostility, popular Arab hostility towards Israel, is effectively the function of Arab authoritarianism, right? That Arab authoritarian Arab governments have ginned up a lot of anti-Israel hatred, anti-Semitism, and that, you know, the central issues are part of these countries. Now, I mean, I think you have always found this to be an empirically problematic claim. I mean, I think that there are lots of examples from the 40s and the 50s where you see Arab governments that are actually driven into hostile poses towards Israel because of popular opinion. And I think you saw that in Iraq in the 1940s and the 1950s, where the Iraqi government really wasn't all that moved by the plight of the Palestinians, but the Iraqi population found it to be much more compelling. And so we are now having sort of a natural experiment. If you remove the authoritarian governments, does the Palestinian issue and the hostility to Israel, and those, I mean, we should be careful about those two, because those are also sort of distinct things, right? How much, and I think that critics would sort of point out that the Palestinian issue versus the existence of Israel are questions that in some sense can be detached, right? I mean, how much, for example, do the protesters care about things like additional Israeli settlements in the West Bank? Yeah. And how much do they care about Israel simply being, you know, destroyed, right? Or whatever. But the idea that Arab anti-Israel attitudes were simply a function of authoritarianism is, we just know it's wrong right now. Empirically, we can say that this is not a plausible argument, that, there are genuinely democratic feelings in these countries that are also happen to have an anti-Israeli character to them and have a pro-Palestinian character to them.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's right. I mean, but I would go back and say, you know, it's still at the same time very true that these authoritarian regimes both allowed and fomented and encouraged hatred toward Israel, to distract from their own failures. But that was really only possible, I think, because these are genuinely held sentiments that were there for them to exploit. I mean, we can, you know, to use a comparison, there's always the question, okay, Osama bin Laden brings up the Palestinian issue in his various fatwas in the 90s, but does he really care about the Palestinian issue? It's like, well, that doesn't really matter. The fact is he understood that his intended audience does or did. Since he is no longer with us. But, you know, as it's a kind of, you know, a fairly skilled propagandist, bin Laden understood that in order to kind of create, to appeal to his intended audience, he needed to bring this up. And we have the same thing with the Iranians, using the Palestinian issue to kind of bridge the Persian-Arab divide, because they understand that this is an issue that it's not something that people were simply, you know, fooled into caring about. It's something that they care about for very understandable reasons. And one of the really interesting things that it's always kind of, you know, stuck me about the attempts by Israeli and American conservatives to simply dismiss these concerns as a creation of Arab authoritarian and Arab propagandists is that I think there's an interesting comparison here to the way that many Americans see the Israeli issue. Mm-hmm. It's not as if I think there are, you know, the relationship between Israel and America for clear reasons. There is a unity, like a cultural identification, Judeo-Christian culture, all of this. But it's deeply held. These are deeply held sentiments for many Americans. But at the same time, I think there is clearly an effort by numerous groups, whether you want to call them a lobby or whatever, to kind of strengthen these feelings and make it the default position of the United States, which I think they've succeeded in doing. But the bottom line is, just as the support for Israel is a kind of important national security check-the-box issue for American politicians, so support for the Palestinians is going to, you know, be for aspiring Arab politicians.
Right. Right. There's another parallel to sort of the way that the Chinese government manages foments and manages anti-Japanese sentiment in China. And this is a very dangerous thing for an authoritarian regime to do, and it's a very dangerous thing for any sort of authoritarian regime, but it's not unusual in periods of discontent for anti-Japanese demonstrations to break out, in part as a way for the Chinese government to direct their attention away from domestic issues. But there is broad anti-Japanese sentiment, right? And there's also a danger, and I think that the Egyptian authorities the Egyptian authorities are in a pickle right now, right? Because there's always a danger in mobilizing nationalist sentiment, right? And the danger is that the nationalists may decide that the current government simply does not meet their needs, right? The current government does not effectively represent the nation. And I think that since the current government is sort of in transition in Egypt, you just really have a very confused approach to how to handle these situations. We're going to get to Turkey a little bit later, but I mean, what do you see as the next 6 months to a year of Egyptian-Israeli relations? I mean, the great fear when the Egyptian Revolution happened, and I don't know if we'll end up calling it the Egyptian Revolution, maybe the first stage of the Egyptian Revolution, was that we would see essentially an abrogation of the peace treaty, that Israel and Egypt, that we would essentially go back to what the situation was before 1979. Now, what is your take on what we're going to see from between Egypt and Israel in the next 6 months to a year?
I don't think we'll see an abrogation of that, of the, you know, the Camp David treaty. Mm-hmm. I think the, you know, the Egypt is still very much run by people who understand how enormously beneficial that treaty was for Egypt, especially for Egypt's leadership, if not for its people. And that's an important distinction to come back to later. I mean, essentially what you did in Camp David was buy off the Egyptian leadership and promise them lots of money in order to be nice to Israel. And unfortunately, those benefits did not really accrue to the Egyptians in the same way that they certainly accrued, I think, to many Israelis. I mean, there are criticisms to be made of Israel's, you know, the way Israel's economics and whether the benefits reach everyone. But, you know, it's much more democratic, clearly, and its economic benefits have really kind of boosted many, many people in the country. I don't think there's any question. But yeah, I don't think we'll see like a direct abrogation of it, but I think we're going to see a government in Egypt that's much, much, under much more pressure, especially as it fails to follow through or make good on sort of the political aspirations and the economic opportunities that many in Tahrir were demonstrating for. It's going to be looking for a pressure release, and it's going to reach for the same one that Arab authoritarians often do, which is the Israeli-Palestinian issue. At the same time, I think if we go back to that the attack after Eilat, where, you know, the Egyptians were killed on the border, when I was in Israel, I mean, I was very struck by, even though it's been called an apology, it was, you know, technically a statement of regret, but still, the speed at which that statement was issued, plus the quick end to the Gaza attack that was launched by Israel in response to that, was not missed by anyone in Israel
or
among the Palestinian officials we spoke to. It's kind of a new day then, you know, for the Israel-Egypt relationship. Israel understood, you know, it clearly got the message from SCAF, listen, we do not need this right now.
Right.
Okay. We don't need to be responding to the kind of anger this is going to create. So I think and Israel responded to that, put out the statement of regret, stopped the attack on Gaza.
Right.
So yeah, I mean so there's, you know, there's evidence that the Israelis understand that they're kind of in a new era right now.
Right. I mean, and I suppose this is one of, and this I think provides a segue to the next issue. The Israeli reaction on this point, which, you know, again, it's not exactly apologetic, but at the same time indicative that the Israelis took good relations with Egypt very seriously and wanted to maintain, is an interesting contrast to how the current Israeli government has played out over the past year and a half or so, relations with Turkey, right? As relations with Turkey have deteriorated, the current Israeli government has, if anything, sort of attempted to escalate and exacerbate at almost every point, right? And this goes from sort of very small petty things like Avigdor Lieberman lecturing I can't remember if it was Lieberman, but somebody lecturing the Turkish ambassador and so forth, to things that Turkey takes very seriously, such as attempting to create a military relationship with Greece, and even hints that that Israel may support in some fashion as what are effectively Kurdish terror groups in eastern Turkey, and it's sort of fascinating. It's like, I mean, Israel really the current Israeli leadership really seems to think that the Turkish relationship is done, right? I mean, that's the only interpretation I can see of it, because they can't think that this is going to intimidate Turkey, right? You know, the idea that coming to a military relationship with Greece right now, when the Greek government is in the midst of, you know, a spectacular public collapse, that this would intimidate Turkey in some fashion rather than just enrage Turkey, would be sort of poorly calculated. And so they must believe that the relationship with Turkey is fatally flawed, and so they might as well shoot it in the head. And that's so much different than how they approach this Egyptian thing.
Yeah.
And I find that fascinating.
Right. No, I think, it is. The Turkish and the Israeli government seem to have entered into some agreement a couple of years ago to just do the stupidest possible things at the stupidest possible moments over the past couple of years. But yeah, as I think I wrote a piece back in February after I was in Israel, when the Egyptian demonstrations were really taking off, and in fact I was there when Mubarak stepped down, And as I wrote then in this piece for The Nation, it's just, you really couldn't overstate how shaken up the Israeli defense establishment was by this. I mean, Turkey, it started to enjoy much better relationships in the 90s, it's true. But Egypt is the cornerstone of Israel's entire strategic concept. The idea that they simply don't have to worry about their western border, and that they can have, you know, one of the leading Arab states kind of just keeping the lid on things for them. I mean, that has, that's been, you know, the cornerstone of their entire worldview since 1980. So there's an enormous difference. I think they regret the Turkish relationship declining. But yeah, there's just really no comparing how important the one is versus the other. As for the PKK thing, I saw that report in Yediot on Friday. Lieberman reportedly threatening that, you know, if they want to escalate, we have things we can do too. I haven't seen that confirmed, but I think, fortunately, I mean, this was a response to Erdogan. I mean, talking about stupid Erdogan talking about Turkish naval escorts of future Gaza flotillas. And I think I've seen that he's kind of walked that back too, which I'm thankful for, because that is really, really unacceptable. But yeah, I think we talked about Dan Dresner's piece talking about Israel's behavior and how its decision not to issue an apology to Turkey is evidence of their belief that it just wouldn't matter. And I think I think that's a good point. I don't agree that the, you know, Netanyahu Lieberman competition urinating contest, whatever you want to call it, didn't play into this at all. I think Abigail Lieberman's rise, you know, occupies BB all the time. But still, I think it's true. Given Turkish behavior, there are real questions of what the Israelis thought they could actually accomplish by issuing such an apology.
I mean, it's interesting that there has been, I mean, you haven't seen much in the way of hedging. And people have, you know, people have brought this up in the context of Iran and brought this up in the context of how threatening Israel actually sees Iran. And the argument being, well, you know, if Israel really saw Iran as a critical existential threat, then it simply wouldn't act the way it has acted with regards to Turkey and to the United States, right? I mean, it wouldn't, and I think we're also probably going to talk about what were reported as Robert Gates' statements about Israel's ungratefulness as an ally, is that If the Israelis really took seriously the problem of Iran as an existential statement, you would see them hedging in some fashion, right? You would see them hedging in order to, you know, at least try to maintain some relationship with Turkey, at least try to maintain good relations with the United States rather than to sort of poke the current U.S. administration. And, you know, you would really expect Israel to hedge in the context of concern about the realignment of Egypt. And yet we don't, I mean, it just doesn't seem like Israel is hedging, right? I mean, they seem to be pursuing all of these. They seem to not have, I guess, let me phrase it this way. Israel seems to lack a coordinated strategy for dealing with Turkey, Iran, and Egypt. That it seems to treat them as three completely separate foreign policy problems that don't affect one another. And that's really weird. And it also appears to me to be at least somewhat self-destructive. I mean, that this seems like a terrible idea, right? I mean, if your relations with Egypt are in a free fall, that probably means you don't want to poke Turkey with a sharp stick, and vice versa, right? And yet, I mean, it's hard for me to see. And Dresner's piece was very interesting because it was very much about short-term thinking about the United States. But it's hard for me to see coordinated strategic thinking coming out of Israel right now on these issues. And they may have just been completely taken aback by the whole Arab Spring thing, and we haven't even talked about Syria and so forth. So, but I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I mean, unfortunately, it seems in the best days, there's not a lot of kind of longer-term strategic thinking in Israel about how all these pieces fit together. I think there's kind of threat assessments, more or less. But I mean, having talked to people in the Strategic Affairs Ministry and other places, I mean, I think there's an understanding of how these pieces fit together. It just doesn't seem to percolate up to the top leadership. You know, clearly there are very skilled and smart people mm-hmm. in Israel who understand kind of the negative, you know, the trajectory that things are on. But I think at the very top, there's an understanding, there's kind of perception of all of this still, even given Turkey's behavior, you know, say, for example, its decision to allow NATO missile defense on its territory, which is clearly pointed at Iran. This sort of evidence doesn't really seem to affect the analysis that Turkey has joined this resistance bloc.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's very confusing and it's very frustrating. But just getting back to you know, the Turkey-Israel relationship, it's interesting, I think. You know, I regret the decline in the relationship between Turkey and Israel. Clearly, for what it means to the U.S., for the U.S. Mm-hmm. mostly, it's going to make things much more difficult. Although I really, unfortunately, one of the effects of U.S. domestic politics is the way that the U.S.-Turkey relationship will, you know, seems like it has to be indexed to the Turkey-Israel relationship, which I think is just
right.
ridiculous. But, you know, looking at Turkey's role in regard to Iran, it's almost like it's built more credibility in the Middle East for mm-hmm. helping the U.S. focus on Iran by getting into a fight with Israel. I mean, I'm not sure that was the exact intention, but mm-hmm. that's just an interesting upshot of what's going on right now.
Right. Well, I mean, to drag this back to domestic politics, another element of the Dresdner Peace was thinking about 2012. But now that you've sort of a couple things that you've mentioned make me again think that. I mean, so let me propose that. You know, maybe trying to circle the square here on all of this stuff. I mean, maybe part of the answer is that the Israeli leadership has fundamentally decided that the relationship with the United States is the absolute crucial crux of all of this, right? That mm-hmm. in some sense they could do without Egypt as long as they have the United States, but they probably won't have to do without Egypt because the Egyptian leadership depends on the goodwill of the United States as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of these things, especially the overtures to Greece, are really about maintaining the friendship of the United States, or about increasing the size of the windset, the domestic windset for Israel in the United States, right? I mean, there is a strong Greek foreign policy lobby in the United States that has had all sorts of effects on, I mean, it's not as well known as the other lobby, but it is, I mean, it has had important policy effects in the past. There is a strong Armenian lobby in the United States. There is a growing Georgian lobby in the United States. And so if we interpret all of these foreign policy adventures as simply trying to create a windset inside U.S. domestic politics, and as Dresdner suggests, that Israel increasingly sees itself as an ally of the GOP, right? Increasingly sees its fate as you know, not which Israel doesn't think that, you know, that Obama, or, you know, it maybe talks about its unhappiness with Obama, but doesn't think Obama's going to abandon it, but sees it itself as getting a much better deal from the GOP. And so, and as Dresdner suggests, is willing to sort of say things that will make it easier to see eventually a President Perry or a President Romney.
Right.
And so sees that as effectively its main strategic goal right now, which is ensuring the health of the relationship with the United States.
Clearly, there's been an effort, certainly by the Likud over the past years, mm-hmm. to cement that relationship specifically with conservative actors,
right.
Republican actors, the Republican establishment.
Mm-hmm.
As for their behavior in regard to the U.S.-Israeli relationship, you know, I think a lot of what Dan wrote made sense. I mean, yeah, there's really no cost to Bibi right now for humiliating the President of the United States, especially after he gives a speech in Congress and gets however many standing ovations. You know, we might see a leaked comment from the Secretary of Defense, and while that's, you know, maybe nice to see, what's the effect of that? You know, Bibi gives us an especially effusive thanks to President Obama a couple days after Obama agrees quickly to help him with the Cairo embassy crisis.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But yeah, there's, especially going into an election season, there's really no pressure at all on Netanyahu to do anything. But in regard to the military relationship, I think there is some cause for Israel to be concerned. Because what Gates said is not, it's not all, you know, within, I think, security circles, it's understood. There's a lot of anger or just concern about Israel's behavior and the impact of Israeli policies on U.S. defense posture and U.S. interests. I think, go back to last year, the most famous part of that was David Petraeus' comments in his written statement to the Senate about the impact of the continuing conflict on U.S. interests. But also, I don't know if I would say equally important, but almost as important, was this piece by Anthony Cordesman at CSIS, just questioning whether Israel was becoming a strategic liability for the United States. And that made an enormous impact on Israeli defense officials who I spoke to shortly after that. And it still occasionally comes up, just because Cordesman, you know, he's about as sort of mainstream and venerated a security analyst as you can get in the United States. And for him to come out with this kind of thing, you know, said a lot. It was not something he just thought up one night and wrote on his own. He was clearly writing to express the opinions of others.
Right. And so, I mean, I think what you're suggesting there is that there is, how to phrase this, there is concern about the wisdom of the Israeli relationship within the professional American security bureaucracy, right? Both the uniformed and the civilian, and some element of the sort of the think tank constellation that surrounds the security. And that should be disconcerting to Israel, but I'm wondering how much that should be disconcerting to Israel. Because, I mean, I suppose my thought would be that as long as you have the headliners, I mean, as long as you have the elected officials who remain, you know, largely, I mean, either very friendly towards Israel in the case of the Democratic Party, or very friendly towards Israel
in the case of the Republican Party.
Right. Then what exactly does it matter that the professional bureaucracy is sort of growing in frustration, right? I mean, this isn't the United Kingdom where the bureaucracy has, although, I mean, the defense bureaucracy is about as close to a United Kingdom-style bureaucracy as you're going to get in the United States. But it's not a situation where the bureaucracy can essentially come up with its own foreign policy, right? I mean, headliners and elected officials, especially when they all agree on something, can really make the bureaucracy do what it wants to do. And so, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I think that Israel can lose Gates and even lose Petraeus, and if that loss doesn't really affect the headline elected officials, then it doesn't really matter. I mean, I'm just sort of tossing thoughts out right now, but that's
I think you're totally right. But it seems clear to me that is where I don't want to just say Israel, but specifically Netanyahu and his gang have really put all their eggs, just maintaining, holding on to Congress, whatever else happens.
Right.
So, I mean, the question is there some event, you know, whether it's some major event or just over time, do these sorts of analyses and complaints and sentiments kind of percolate up such that Congress can't ignore them as easily? Right. And I think the reason we've gotten to this point is, you know, interestingly, we had the Bush administration take a number of policies that put tens of thousands of U.S. troops in the Middle East. They hadn't been there in those numbers before. And what these troops reported back to their superiors, among other things, about the Arabs that they were meeting, was that, you know, this issue, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, creates problems for us. People actually care about this.
Right. It needs to be taken seriously.
What?
It needs to be taken seriously.
Right. And it's not just an invention of anti-Israel propagandists. It is a political fact on the ground. And again, I think that is really, that understanding has really impacted the U.S. defense establishment, but it has yet to really impact the political establishment.
Right. All right. Well, unfortunately, I have to dash now. So we will have to have this conversation another time.
All right, great talking to you.
I mean, I think we pretty much solved the problem here anyway, so really another 5 minutes would be extraneous. I mean, it would be unnecessary. So we sort of set forth the path, and so.
All right, well, talk to you later.
All right, well, have a good day.
Bye-bye,
too. Right, bye-bye, and thank you for watching.